Shudmila, for your kind introduction, and good afternoon, all the participants. I'm very honored to have been invited to present to you my insights on the use of universal jurisdiction and how it can help to address international crimes. So to start, I have prepared a presentation that I'm going to share with everyone now, in case you did not get it. I will also share my screen now, so you can either follow the presentation through the shared screen on Zoom, or you can also open the presentation on your browser. So, let me start. Okay, so the topic we are going to cover today concerns universal jurisdiction and how it can be used to address international crimes. And first of all, let me say just a few words about the organization I work with, European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. We are a Berlin-based collective of lawyers and activists, and the main mission of the organization is to address human rights violations through litigation. And for this, we approach different legal avenues, be it national courts or regional courts, such as the European Court for Human Rights or the International Criminal Court. And the goal behind this work is to stop impunity and to bring accountability, but also to advocate for more and stronger legal instruments to bring accountability. And I work within the program as the Director of International Crimes and Accountability within ECCHR, and I would like to share with you here today some insights of the last 4 years work with this organization. So we are going to cover quite a lot of information in this presentation, and I will try to keep it as short as possible, but it is a complex topic. And on the very first slide, you will see that we're going first to cover the framework. So what is universal jurisdiction? Then we're going to go further to our, let's say, methodology on how we build cases. Then we will continue with establishing a bigger context to litigation with the use of universal jurisdiction. And then subsequently, we will have a case study with regard to the crimes committed in Syria and how we address those by means of universal jurisdiction. And finally, conclusion outlook. And then I'm very happy to hear your comments, thoughts, or receive some questions. So let's start with the framework. Universal jurisdiction as a framework. So you see a definition of universal jurisdiction. Jurisdiction to prosecute international crimes without connection to the country. Let's try to break it down, what it means. So jurisdiction to prosecute international crimes arises, on the one hand, from international treaties that include certain provisions that provide for obligation for the states to prosecute certain crimes. For example, the first one, Geneva Conventions, oblige states to prosecute war crimes, then Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel and Inhuman Treatment contains obligation to prosecute torture. Rome Statute, duty for the member states to prosecute international crimes, and the most recent one, Convention on Enforced Disappearances, obligation to exercise jurisdiction over enforced disappearances under certain circumstances. On the other hand, we have national laws that are set in place to define this obligation or ability of states to exercise universal jurisdiction. So here we have criminal codes or special laws within the national system that mirror, for example, the Rome Statute or the Convention Against Torture. So these laws specifically enable or oblige states to prosecute certain crimes that they decided to, let's say, to exercise jurisdiction over. Now let's have a look at what these crimes are. So here we speak about crimes against international law and so-called jus cogens. Jus cogens are norms of international law that are non-derogable for states or where no justification can be provided for violation of such norms. And when we speak of international crimes, we can speak of standalone crimes, such as a crime of torture or enforced disappearance. And on the other hand, we also speak of so-called contextual crimes, such as war crimes or crimes against humanity or genocide. Contextual crimes are basically also individual crimes that have a bigger context, let's say an armed conflict or war crimes, or in the case of crimes against humanity, it's a systematic or widespread attack against civilian population. So why do states prosecute or have to exercise universal jurisdiction over those crimes? It's because they are grave, so grave that they concern international community as a whole, and therefore they should not go unpunished. Now, let's have a look at the last bit of the definition. So, jurisdiction to prosecute crimes without connection to the country. First of all, what could be the connection to the country? So, it could be the territorial link that where the crime was committed. So, the state is obliged to prosecute crimes if they were committed on its territory. It could be active personality or passive personality. Basically, if the perpetrator of the crime is a citizen of the country, or a victim or a survivor or witness of the crime is the citizen of the country. Well, the pure universal jurisdiction does not, as a framework, does not require any of these links to be fulfilled for the state or the prosecutorial authorities of the state to exercise jurisdiction. Now, on the right, you see quite a number of European states, and on the left side, you see a few other non-European states that, to a certain degree, can exercise universal jurisdiction. So, for example, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Finland, they have such national laws in place that allow them to exercise universal jurisdiction without link to the country. When we look at France or Spain or Netherlands, they do require a personality link. So, for example, for the French prosecutor to take up the case based on universal jurisdiction, it needs to be a French citizen whose rights were violated or against whom an international crime was committed. Now, it is, let's say, a pure universal jurisdiction is a broad concept, but there is also the so-called prosecutorial discretion. So it is a choice to deviate from the principle of mandatory prosecution in certain situations. So it means that the prosecutor can decide not to prosecute crimes in certain conditions. For example, in Germany, it's in situations where there is no nexus or link to the country. So what I want to say with this is that although some frameworks of universal jurisdiction might appear very broad, prosecutorial authorities still have a certain mechanism to decide whether they do want to fulfill their obligation or not. And of course, you need to consider the complementarity principle, meaning that whenever there is an investigation open in one state and there is a chance of prosecution of a crime, another state is not supposed to open, let's say, a parallel investigation. So, Now, having looked at this definition, let's have a look at procedure. These are steps, very simplified steps of a criminal procedure, and it's based on the procedure in Germany. But again, it's a very simplified version, of course, of them, just for us to get an impression of what the procedure is. So the first step, investigation. This one is the investigation is being carried out by prosecutorial authorities and criminal police. And they receive either information in form of a complaint, or they do their research, or receive information from other authorities or other national services, and they start an investigation. So once they have strong enough evidence against one concrete individual who is suspected of having committed an international crime, they submit this information to a local court, which is then in charge has to decide whether an arrest warrant should be issued and whether the main proceedings should be opened. So, of course, at this stage, a local court can also drop the investigation and say that no main proceedings will take place. But in case the main proceedings are allowed, the local court will designate a special court that will deal with the case for the next year or years. And then we come to the enforcement proceedings once the trial has come to a result. And these steps can vary very much depending on the case. So one investigation might last years and years and do not result in an opening of a main proceeding. Other investigations go rather quickly and shortly lead to a successful prosecution. So, now that we have kind of got a first impression, let's have a look at the challenges. So, challenges and limitations. First challenge that we as an organization, for example, came across in our work is political considerations. So we not only worked on cases concerning Syria that have now led to a trial being opened, but we have also submitted criminal complaints and dossiers with regard to conduct of high-level U.S. officials with regard to the torture program. For example, the current head of the CIA, Gina Haspel, or other powerful actors. And unfortunately, in those cases, no investigation has been opened or no investigatory steps have been undertaken by prosecutorial authorities in Germany. On the other hand, we have the Syrian cases where there is obviously more, where we speak of more results. So we should be aware that there is definitely political consideration in place. The same we can also see if we have a closer look at the development before the International Criminal Court. Then the second point, the prospect of a successful conviction. So let's say a prosecutor gets a case on their table, and they need to see whether they should invest time into investigation of this case. And for this, they need to understand, well, how successful or how realistic or probable is that their investigation will eventually lead to the main proceeding and at some point also to a successful conviction. Because in case there is little chance of, let's say, the suspect actually being arrested and brought to Germany and the case being able to be strong enough, in case the chances are little, the prosecutor might not be willing to look into the case. Well, then there are also financial considerations and costs of the trial. So one of the trials on international crimes in Germany took place some years ago, and it concerns the responsibility of two Congolese militia leaders. And this trial lasted for over 4 years. And of course, we need to be aware that whenever a decision is being made to open a big trial on international crimes, there are also such considerations at stake. Then we, of course, also speak of complexity and number of crimes that prosecutorial authorities deal with. And also in connection with this, long investigations and proceedings. So especially with crimes that are systematic or that are complex, for example, use of prohibited munition or systematic torture in detention, it does take time for the prosecutorial authorities to gather strong evidence to bring it to the main proceeding. Then the next point, also another challenge, is lack of resources. It's not just from the financial point of view, but also with regard to expertise and language. So, for example, in the case of Syria, it was necessary to have staff within the prosecutorial authorities who speak Arabic, who also have certain background and understand the history of the country and what has happened during the conflict since 2011. Another challenge, access to evidence, and in case, for example, the evidence is abroad, for the prosecutorial authorities, it is hard to progress or to advance the case in case they cannot access the evidence and they cannot build a strong case against one concrete individual. And then the last one, also a certain limitation, are the travel bans, basically sanctions where individuals are not allowed to enter the country anymore, and those they cannot also be arrested at the main proceeding to take place, given that national laws of certain countries do not allow prosecution in absence of suspects. So let's have a look at opportunities. And the first one is that there are, the good news is that there are specialized international crimes units in place in various states. So for example, Germany established a war crimes unit in 2008, if I'm not mistaken. And such units are there basically to look specifically for cases for prosecution of international crimes and cases that are that can go before court. A second good news is that there is constant exchange between prosecutorial authorities. So within Europe, there is a special network of prosecutors. And we see how prosecutorial authorities of different states, like Germany and France, built so-called joint investigation teams, for example, to investigate against suspects who are based in two different European countries, and then also to potentially carry out an arrest in two countries at the same time. Now, the next point is documentation and case building by civil society. So this is a great chance because in the last years or the last decade, civil society did a great job in making sure that human rights violations and international crimes are well documented and have even put together ready cases that are almost ready to be prosecuted. And the same goes also for the efforts of UN mechanisms that pursue similar mission as the civil society, but they do work discreetly with the prosecutorial authorities and share the gathered information with them in a discreet way. Another good development is digitalization and archiving of evidence. So we are confronted with more and more open source information that could potentially be used in universal jurisdiction cases. We have seen already, for example, cases in Sweden built around a Facebook photograph, or we have seen video materials being used by the International Criminal Court. So it is a good development because it will allow prosecutorial authorities to look to access evidence from their table, or to access certain evidence from their office. And on the other hand, they will also have archived evidence that can be used at a later stage potentially as well. Then, of course, the growing experience of state institutions and civil society, the more cases there are, the faster, hopefully, things will, cases will develop. And another good news is that not all suspects are under travel bans, and they still do travel. And even in the last few years, we have seen suspects entering the European Union countries, in some cases even despite travel bans, but we will cover this just in a second. So, now we have established the framework, and let's have a look at how we can build cases. So this part again relies on methodology of our organization, and it can by no means be exhaustive. I have just tried to put it as concise as possible. And let's start with a preparation part, the first step. So first of all, we ask ourselves, what is the goal behind bringing a case, for example, built on universal jurisdiction, and what kind of an outcome do we expect? So on the one hand, it could be, for example, a criminal complaint covering a lot of different crimes, and it could also be a dossier against one concrete individual who will, let's say, travel to Germany next week. So depending on what the goal is, we also try to see how we can potentially develop our communication strategy and advocacy strategy. Then important is, of course, the possible impact. So we file, let's say, a dossier against an individual traveling to Germany, and let's say the communication is too big, and he or she's are scared to travel again next time. So it is a good, let's say, chilling effect on the perpetrators, but on the other hand, we do want also to progress with the case. So you need to see what kind of impact do you want to achieve when you bring a case and make it public. And of course, the overall picture, it needs to be made sure that it fits into all efforts of other civil society actors, and it does not contradict the interests of each other. Then we establish the framework. So which jurisdiction do we go for? Germany or other jurisdictions, other states? What are the legal requirements there? We, of course, look at the elements of crime, time frame. Then a really important part is partners. In case it's a bigger project, you need to make sure that you work with partners. So we work a lot with local partners who are either based still in the country on the ground, or who exiled, as is, for example, the case with Syria. And it is important to make sure that they also bring their perspective on how to develop this case. Then, of course, the practical parts, timeline and resources. It's important to make sure that the effort is sustainable and it's not going to be, let's say, dropped the day after the submission. And the last bit in security of data, safety of research. It's important to make sure that, for example, the witness testimonies are handled with certain standards of security, and because we do not want to put anyone at risk, and also people who are involved in the work, especially those who are on the ground, their safety should also be, of course, considered. Now, the next step is establishing facts. When we start building a case, we want to know what is already out there. We don't want to duplicate efforts. We need to see what kind of information is accessible, how is it reliable. So we map the sources, and then we also understand what the gaps are and how these should be filled and what kind of research should be undertaken. Well, once we have established the facts, we look at evidence. I have categorized evidence here into three parts. So crime-based evidence is any kind of evidence that provides information on the crime itself. So what happened on the, on the site of crime. Then, to the right, we have linkage evidence. Linkage evidence allows to link the crime and the perpetrator, and therefore it's essential for any universal jurisdiction cases. And then we have contextual evidence. Contextual evidence allows to establish the context around the crime. So let's say when we speak of the torture committed during an armed conflict, contextual evidence will allow us to establish, let's say, the overall picture that there was an armed conflict going on. So what kind of materials can be used as evidence or supportive information? Of course, it's testimonies of survivors, witnesses, defectors, insider witnesses who have previously served for the state. Official documentation, meaning any kind of documents from the state that shed light on the crime or maybe the chain of command behind the perpetrator. Medical reports, of course, essential once the survivor was released from detention to get a medical examination. Then reports of international organizations, visual materials, testimonies of expert witnesses and open source information. So, and of course, it's also it also concerns witnesses and survivors. Out of time reasons, I will keep this part very short. So first of all, of course, it's important to make sure that it's a survivor-centered approach. Whenever we work with people, it's essential to understand what do they expect from participation in this. And consent is essential. So whenever we work with survivors, it's important to get their consent on what will happen if they share their information, with whom is it going to be shared. So whenever, let's say, civil society actors take information, it is important to make sure that survivors understand that this information might be shared for universal jurisdiction purposes. Training for the work with survivors is essential, and it's important also to have a sustainable approach to this so that people are not left behind after they've given the testimony. So it's important to stay in touch after we have taken the testimony. So, for example, we also offer psychosocial support. We refer survivors to asylum lawyers in case their safety situation or asylum situation is not clear. And for this, you, of course, need to put certain structures in place. And expectations management is essential because we, of course, don't want to promise the survivors that the justice is coming tomorrow, because in the majority of cases, it's an extremely long process, sometimes also with no prospects of accountability. So it is important to keep in mind that we inform whoever we work with of what this road will be like. Now let's have a look at the next part, legal analysis. I don't want to go too much into detail here at this part of, let's say, project development. We do establish the crime, we look at material elements. On the other hand, we, of course, establish the individual criminal responsibility and look into the personal conduct of the suspects. So, for example, with our Syria cases that I will cover in depth, one part of the complaint was on establishing what happened in detention facilities. And then we have established a number of 10 to 20 individuals who are, who we thought basically who were suspected to have committed those crimes in those detention facilities. So the second part of the complaint would cover the individual criminal responsibility part. Well, if there are any questions, we can come back to the slide and I can share more information with you on this. Once the complaint dossier or whatever piece of information we want to share on universal jurisdiction is ready and submitted, we of course also think about communication and advocacy. And here the questions, of course, arise. Do we go public? Is it strategic to go public or not? When do we go public? As timing might be very important. Who is the audience? Do we want to convince the state authorities or do we want to, let's say, narrate it to the general audience? Advocacy, of course, we also ask ourselves whenever we approach certain stakeholders, do we advocate for the topic, for the case, or do we want to advocate for stronger universal jurisdiction frameworks? In the lower part of the slide, you can see what else is important. Coordination with partners, of course, is essential to make sure that our efforts do not contradict. And it has proven to be important to communicate in several languages. So, for example, with regard to Syria, we communicate whatever information we want to share with the public in German, English, and Arabic. Sometimes also in other languages if necessary. And again, consider sustainability of efforts. We need to make sure that the topic stays on the agenda, that it is part of political agenda whenever there are conversations between political stakeholders, for example. Yes. So,
okay. So we have covered this part, and
I'm sure there might be clarification questions, but I would like to ask you to keep those to the end. I keep an eye on the time, and I'm aware of the time. So let's keep going. So, universal jurisdiction is one part of a bigger context, of course. It's first of all part of accountability efforts altogether, for which there are different legal avenues, such as regional courts and also the International Criminal Court, or again, national courts of countries, of course. But beside this, there are, of course, other measures that need to be taking place for accountability also to work. It's capacity building for the civil society, it's documentation and preservation of evidence, just to make sure that it is being documented thoroughly throughout as long as crimes are committed. Again, public outreach and narrative are play also an important part in this coordination, cooperation already mentioned, and advocacy. So I just wanted to share the slide with you to show that universal jurisdiction is just a small piece of a bigger puzzle, let's say, and therefore it needs a coordinated effort from the different parts of this context. Okay, now we have come to the case study, and here I would like to draw your attention first to the right side of the slide, accountability efforts for the crimes committed in Syria. First, I would like just to give you a brief overview of certain specifics, so and to give you a little bit of a background. So since March 2011 in Syria, countless crimes have been committed, both in connection to the armed conflict, but also without the connection to the armed conflict. And these crimes were committed by various parties. So we are talking about not just one state, but other states have also participated in these crimes, namely, the coalition built, the coalition led by the United States, Russia, Turkey,
Would you like me to? Okay, I will collect.